I'm Senior Portfolio Strategist Jim Haskell. Recently, co-CIOs Bob Prince and Greg Jensen published a three-part series that outlined the challenges and potential solutions to managing money in a zero interest rate environment. At Bridgewater, we believe this is the most important topic facing all investors going forward. So today, I sit down with Bob and Greg to further explore the issues around this topic and answer some of the commonly asked questions that investors continue to wrestle with. We hope you enjoy the conversation. Bob, let's start by exploring the main challenges you and Greg wrote about with respect to managing money in a zero interest rate environment with high policy-induced liquidity.
Yeah, I think that getting a handle on the zero interest rate environment requires you to recognize the multiple dimensions of impact that this has. I think you can sort of put it into four broad categories of influence. So number one is the impact on bonds as an asset class and their returns. Number two is the impact of the zero interest rate on other assets vis-a-vis the discount rate effect. The third impact is the impact on portfolios with respect to correlation, diversification, and balance. And the fourth impact is on economies. And these four influences interact with one another to create a very different investment environment. Just hitting on a couple of the specifics pertaining to each one of those, you know, when you look at bonds as an asset class, the return is now close to zero. But in addition to that, the return has an asymmetric payout pattern. If you just allow bonds to go from where they are now literally to zero, you'd make about 7% over the next 3 years. But for example, if the real yield drifted up to its normal level, you'd lose 20%. So you've got a 3-to-1 loss to gain proportionality there. When you look at the impact of the zero interest rate as a discount rate on other assets, you both lose the ability for the discount rate to fall to cushion a decline in the cash flows on those assets. But in addition, you lose the wind at the back of asset returns for 40 years has been a decline in bond yields from 14-15% down to zero. And so to look back at historical returns, you don't have that going forward. And then obviously, when you look at a portfolio, because the discount rate can fall and bonds can rally when that happens during a period of adverse economic conditions, bonds have been a great diversifier during periods of economic downturns when cash flows are falling. The rally in bonds can help to cushion that. And then I think the last thing is that when you look at economies, a similar effect, which is that if you have an economic downturn, historically, we've always had the ability for an interest rate to fall to cushion that downturn and also cushion the decline in earnings that would come with that. But also the ability to cut interest rates and stimulate a credit expansion. So the ability to create a boom in economic conditions is substantially diminished. So when you put all of those characteristics together, this is really a very big impact on the investment climate and requires a lot of thought to think about what to do about it.
Greg, up until now, we've been advising investors that even at low bond yields, bonds can be very useful as a portfolio diversifier. And in fact, investors that went with that advice have benefited from it. Why are we changing our advice now on the usefulness of nominal bonds?
Well, you're exactly right. Some of the best bond rallies ever have been from, 3% levels where people thought bond yields were incredibly low all the way down to the current levels. This has been some of the best periods to have bonds, and they've served an incredibly important purpose in the portfolios in terms of balancing equity moves. But getting to the mechanics, there is the mechanics to what can they do now, right? There's a difference when you don't have very little yield curve slope. Okay. So a lot of people think of the bond yield, the 3% bond yield. When you have a 3% bond yield and a 0% short rate, you have a very, very steep yield curve slope and can make a lot of money on bonds relative to cash. But now you've gotten to the point where the yield curves are quite flat and while there's not a tight zero interest rate bound on bonds, there is some level of negative interest rates unless they get rid of cash. That becomes an arbitrage back to cash. So when we've looked at that, you can definitely see bond yields trade negative 50, negative 1%, but it's going to get hard beyond that because people can move on to storing cash and doing other things if the bond yield become so negative, so penalizing that they do that. So we've calculated that for different currencies, and it's in that range where it'll be very difficult to prevent people from stop to arbing with cash. And so there's some limit there on bond yields unless they get rid of cash, and that those are those levels are real. So you can't get as much diversification from bonds now, while you could from 3 to 0.5. And you can do different things with bonds when you have steep yield curve slopes than when you have flat yield curve slopes. So those things have changed. And now the benefit that we saw from 3 down to these levels is no longer available for investors. And that's why we think it's time to really have these conversations. So the main question from our perspective is for everybody to have a strategy, whether you get out of all your bonds now, whether you have a strategy to get out of them as they come down to even lower and lower yields, whatever it is, to take a look at this challenge and determine the best plan for them.
Greg, we've just discussed how assets and the economy are going to behave very differently going forward and how investors need to have a game plan for dealing with those new realities. Maintaining diversification in the new environment is as important as ever. And in the daily observations, you laid out a number of practical steps that investors can take. Let's start with the idea of shifting from nominal bonds to inflation-sensitive assets, with gold and inflation-linked bonds as liquid market examples. Why do you focus on those particular assets?
I think you have to visualize, well, what's going to happen in a world of the next economic slowdown? What are the policy responses? What assets will do well, even if equities don't do well? And our basic view on that is you're now in an MP3 world where when there's a slowdown, the government response is somewhat predictable. There'll be more money printing and more fiscal spending. And what assets, if that money doesn't flow into equities, what assets will that flow into? And if you look at that history of periods of big money printing and periods of big fiscal expansion, it's our experience that things like gold and inflation index bonds can create that. Those are the liquid instruments that we use. But beyond that, just thinking through, what are you going to be doing to be balanced, let's say, in a more stagflationary environment than an inflationary, a reflationary environment that's bullish for equities? And that's how we went about thinking about the question, which is how do you get the great balance? Then we were able to stress test that balance across all reflation since 1800. And find that this balance, it works well. So even if you can't have bonds, you can have this mix and it works, and it can work at zero interest rates because real yields can continue to fall as inflation rises if necessary in these conditions.
So just exploring that a little bit deeper, when you look at the expected returns from here of inflation index bonds and gold, aren't they below what a lot of investors need? I mean, real yields are already negative in pretty much around the world. And over the long term, gold tends to just keep up with inflation. So since both markets have already rallied a lot, are they still advisable to put in a portfolio on their own?
Well, I think, Jim, all asset classes are reflecting low likely real returns over a very long period of time. Two points that are relevant to that is in the short term, that could be quite different as we adjust to this new paradigm that we're in. There could be big moves in certain markets in that period. And then secondly, that it's low real returns. You could get high nominal returns and probably will need to achieve in order to maintain asset prices where they are. You're going to need to have higher nominal GDP and probably get reasonable nominal returns. But that doesn't tell you that there'll be high real returns. So recognizing A, the difference between the nominal and the real returns, and B, the differences in the time frame, that as we're transitioning, so few people have protection in this environment, we do think there'll be a continued adjustment in those assets as people try to get that protection. And so that could lead to extended returns in the short term, even though in the very long term, you're right, the real returns on IL bonds are going to be low. And the main question is, what will the nominal returns be?
Greg, we talked about the fact that nominal bonds are likely to stay around zero, even if it's not an official policy to peg them there. When you look back in time, when did real yields actually fall when nominal yields were stable around zero?
Well, we haven't had a lot of environments like this, but you can easily have it. If you take the 1940s, we think that's probably the best kind of example where you had huge moves in real yields up and down while nominal yields were pegged. And when you look at the policy that's necessary, if you get to MP3, you want to allow the government to spend fiscally as necessary to achieve the economy, because the interest rate lever won't work to do that. And therefore, the Fed's in the position of accommodating that. And you can see massive moves in real yields in that period. Of course, there weren't inflation index bonds per se, but if they had followed the policy through the war in the 40s and then even in the post-war period, what you would have seen is huge moves in inflation index bonds and basically no moves in nominal bonds. So that's the kind of world. It's a very possible world when you look at those periods, understanding them so necessary because you can visualize a set of policies so different than the policies we're used to. Just take the last 6 weeks as a good example. You're seeing it. U.S. real yields are making new lows as nominal bonds are stuck. And that's a function of the fiscal policy starting to play out. And more of that could lead to a significantly larger move. And when you look across countries, there's even more room.
Bob, another concept you discussed in the Daily Observations was the idea of shifting into equities with more stable cash flows and cash flow-based investing more generally. Can you embellish on that concept a little more?
Yeah, I think this will be a really interesting area of thought and research as we go forward, not just for us, but I think probably for everybody. So one of the ways that we've been thinking about this is to sort of take the returns of an asset and split it into two parts, split it into the cash flow part of the return and then the discount rate part of the return, and explicitly recognize the drivers of each one of those things. And when you do that, it sort of opens up a whole pathway for portfolio structuring, which is to just disregard the pricing and the returns for a moment. We'll come back to that. But to look at the nature of the cash flows of the assets and then what drives those cash flows. And then from there, there are kind of the two paths that you can follow. One is, can I find assets that have cash flows that just won't have a sensitivity to a decline in the economic environment? You know, we refer to that as a stable cash flows. But also on the other side of that, can I identify assets that actually have a pretty decent exposure to the environment, but offsetting and balancing? That you can balance cash flows of one asset versus another and create a portfolio of assets whose cash flows are well diversified. When you look back through history, what you can see is that you can actually create a much more diversified portfolio of cash flows in assets, whether they're publicly or privately traded, than the correlation of the returns. And that's because historically the discount rate applies to everything uniformly. But as we go forward, the discount rate is not going to be as much of an effect, but also recognizing that over time, if I'm going 5 or 10 years out into the future, ultimately the cash flows is the dominant force on the returns anyway. And so as a longer term investor, can I think in terms of structuring portfolios that have generally reliably rising cash flows over time, regardless of the economic environment, because of either good diversification or because I've just chosen a set of assets that have those characteristics, and that can give me a reasonable expectation of a positive return over time, and sort of with the discount rate affecting things over the shorter term, but I know that will net out over time in a positive way for me. And so one of the ways that we've done that is to say, well, you know, what types of spending in the environment don't have a cyclical exposure? What kinds of spending are going to occur no matter what the economy does and across any country in the world? And so we've identified types of spending. Literally, if you go to the personal consumption report, there are 200 categories of spending, very specific types of spending. Like literally, it's kind of funny, like literally there, how much is spent on eggs is in there. How much is spent on beef relative to poultry, relative to veal or pork. So very specific types of spending where you can literally say, is that kind of spending going to occur in an economic downturn or a pandemic? And you can go then across countries. And so by identifying types of spending that are going to occur no matter what, you can neutralize what would normally be a decline in the cash flows that would have to get offset by the discount rate and just not experience that decline in cash flows. So that's one way of engineering the portfolio to deal with that.
Greg, let me turn to you. Geographic diversification will play a bigger role in portfolios than maybe it has before. Can you give us a little sense of what you're thinking there?
Yeah, well, you're right, Jim, that first off, across all time, we think being significantly more geographically diversified than most portfolios are will benefit the outcomes of the portfolio. Now, over the last 20 years, that hasn't been a big deal because so many of the assets across the world have been really highly correlated. But they've been highly correlated because of the free flow of capital, the globalization of trade and all of these trends. Going forward, we think there's a bigger and bigger chance of major differentials across countries. So the level of correlation could easily and likely fall when you look at what's going on geopolitically and with trade and all of those things, a high chance that you'll have winners and losers in the world. And as you think through a strategic asset allocation, you want to have an asset allocation that isn't betting too much that you'll choose the winner. So essentially, when we look at it today, we've got three major blocks in the world. You know, you've got the Chinese block with its own monetary policy. You've got the US block and to some extent a European block. And being more balanced across those because they're each different, and that you wouldn't want to start with a major view on which one will end up end up the best. So for us, getting good balance across the different monetary policies and different risk premiums in the world is what we're trying to do. And really think going forward, it's going to be a lot more important. And because it hasn't been important for 20, 25 years, it's been neglected in many people's portfolios. So we think it's a very important thing to put under the microscope as you go through strategic reviews of your asset allocations.
Now, one of the blowbacks on geographical diversification is that we're seeing rising tensions throughout the world, particularly between the US and China, for example. And of course, many investors worry that this could continue to escalate, leading to capital wars or even worse. How do you factor that in when you're thinking about the merits of geographical diversification?
Well, there are risks to all the investments, Jim, and that's certainly a risk as you think about geographic diversification, although it cuts different ways. What's the world going to be like? What are the markets going to be like in different places if the world kind of separates in that way and we move from interdependence to independence? And we look at that and say, we're not sure. You know, that in some ways, Asia might be better off than the US. In other ways, you might believe the opposite. But whatever that is, being diversified to that is, from an economic perspective, would be sort of our neutral assumption. Now, there is reason, and totally understand, there's reason you could believe maybe you should just be in your home country. If you're actually going to go to a real war, you're certainly not going to want to have money in the other country. But somewhere short of that, there's so much benefit to being diversified across those regions rather than concentrated in one of those regions in the portfolio. So you got to weigh those risks. And from our perspective, the benefit of the diversification, the fact that in a lot of ways, the risks, you're mentioning some of the risks of, let's say, being in Asia or China, those risks are real, but they're small relative to the huge risks you have of, let's say, being in the West, where you're already at zero interest rates, you have very difficult domestic conflict as well as the international conflict. You have a long-term outlook and high debt levels that's going to make it very hard to have real returns in assets, as we talked about before. So when you net out the risks on both sides, our basic view is a starting point would be, who knows, you'd rather be balanced to those different types of risks than be concentrated in one.
Bob, the central premise is that we're in an MP3 world. But as Greg has pointed out previously, policymakers may not be able to get what they want. One way they don't get what they want is if reflation turns to problematic inflation, and we've discussed that. But another way is if they aren't able to produce the necessary stimulation. Let's focus on that. What can investors do to protect themselves from a world of sustained deflation were that to be the outcome?
Well, the first thing is deflation is a problem no matter what. So it's not like deflation is a new risk. Deflation is a risk that already existed. Inflation is also a risk that exists. And the best thing you can do is try to mitigate as much of both of those as you can. And that's the purpose of finding balance in the portfolio. I think most portfolios are exposed to deflation already, and they're also exposed to inflation. So we think the move to inflationary assets is a very beneficial move. It doesn't cost you in terms of increased risk of deflation. Nonetheless, when you look at deflation, the you have to connect deflation to the economic environment that you're in. Can you, if you had deflation with favorable economic conditions, which is completely possible, that could be a very favorable environment for assets. It may hurt your IL bonds, but your equities would do well.
Ray has mentioned, he said literally, cash is trash, but wouldn't cash be a good option to hold in a deflationary type of environment?
In a deflationary environment, yeah, it would be a good asset to hold. But you don't know if you're going to have inflation or deflation. And right now, central banks are reflating. So the policy direction is actually in the other direction, where they're trying to make cash a very bad thing to hold. Not just cash, but bonds. That they're essentially trying to sustain economic conditions by making cash very unattractive and by making bonds very unattractive in both nominal and real terms, in order to get people to use those assets as a funding vehicle for other assets that support the economy, either through borrowing or through or just selling one to buy the other. And they're producing a lot of liquidity that you can then sell to buy the other. So definitely cash would be a good asset to hold in deflation, but it's a bad asset to hold in inflation. And the question is what mix of assets would you want to hold that gives you the best balance for both? You just don't have to worry about which one of those you're going into.
Yeah, and just to add to that, Jim, because we think about this a lot. So first off, one point is that you do want to consider the freedom of policymakers, right? You rarely see extended deflations when policymakers have fiscal policy and have their own currency that they can print. You rarely see extended dangerous deflation. It doesn't mean you can't have a little bit, but dangerous deflation, because they have the tools and it's pretty obvious what to do and generally are doing it. So when you look at that, that's part of the study of all the reflations, is they're successful against deflations unless they're stuck. If they're stuck in a gold peg or stuck in currency peg or something like that, they're successful when they're not stuck. So that would be point one. Point two, also, it's worth noting that when you talk about gold as an example, deflations are not necessarily bad. Don't think of gold only as a inflation asset. It's not. It's also a monetary stability asset. If you're in a deflation, eventually the markets recognize the need to get out of that. Gold could be a good or at least stable asset in those types of deflations as well. So when we looked at all the significant painful deflations, you know, really gold plus nominal bonds, and now it's different for nominal bonds because of how stuck they are, but gold and nominal bonds were the right combo. And gold was a reasonable part of that is an asset that creates some balance in that unstable deflationary depression, because it's not solely an inflation asset.
Bob, Greg, thanks so much for your time.